Now, get ready to spend the next 2 hours with our three sports-loving ladies. Mia O'Brien, Lauren Brooks, and Taylor Dahl.
This is Helmets and Heels
on 1010XL, switched on by First Coast Lighting and Fans. Upscale lighting, fans, and home decor. Show me what you got, pretty lady.
Well, we talked about it yesterday, ladies. Draft week is here, and I, for one, am so excited that we get to stop talking about mock drafts and we get to start talking about the players that the Jaguars will have drafted. By the way, Helmets and Heels on location both Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, we'll be at Mr. Chubby's in Ponte Vedra, so come hang out with us noon to 2 there. And then on Friday, Players Grill Mandarin, also, of course, noon to 2 p.m., so come hang out with us and give us your thoughts on who you think on Thursday the Jaguars should draft, and on Friday, what you think of their pick. Hopefully 17, I guess that's what I'm going to say, because if they trade back, I'm just going to be on pins and needles. I just want the pick, either move up or pick at 17. I don't want to wait. I don't like that trading back. I'm too impatient of a person, and besides, we've waited for so long now. Mia, I heard you earlier on Jaguars Today talking more about the pick and everything. As of right now, this will change, of course, between now and Thursday night, but as of right now, do the Jaguars pick at 17, trade up, trade back?
No. I can almost take that to the bank right now. Whether it's trading up or trading back, they're not picking at 17. That's
so
my draft.
My hopes and my dreams, Taylor, are
out the window. I mean, there's a chance they move up. There's a chance they move back. I mean, that's the one thing that I would almost, you know, I would put bigger odds on they do not pick at 17 than I would they're going to trade back or they're going to trade up, because I just think that they are in that sweet spot where, whether it's they do want to go get that elite wide receiver, which, by the way, is the only reason I believe they would trade up, or if they want to trade back because there's a team that sees an edge rusher or a tackle who falls, wants to get into the fray, as has been highly documented by plenty of our colleagues here in Jacksonville. If the Jaguars really do covet Kool-Aid McKinstry, but let's say Cooper DeJean's on the board, he doesn't really fit the Jaguars scheme, but the Philadelphia Eagles decide we need to get him before we pick at 22, do they flip with them? I would say it is more likely that the Jaguars trade the pick in some variety than it is they actually stick and pick.
Interesting. I feel like I've been so locked in, Taylor, to 17 and what will happen leading up to that. That's also why we've done this series of interviewing different people from around the country to get their thoughts and who they think their team is going to take. But if you don't pick at 17, oh my goodness, the possibilities then are really endless.
Well, and it changes so much, because obviously if you trade up, that's changing. And like Mia said, you would assume if they were trading up, and especially if it was a pretty decent size trade up, then it would be for one of those wide receivers that everyone's kind of looking at right now. So that would obviously change things drastically, because right now we've more so been like, it looks like maybe Brian Thomas will be that like only top end wide receiver around that area. We've talked about the depth. There's more guys you could get later in those second and third rounds. But I was even when they were talking about Chad Ryder on
Jaguars Today yesterday,
when he was talking to them yesterday, he was even mentioning about how once you hit like pick 23, it's second rounders. Like, that's what he said. He was like, you're not getting a first round draft pick once you hit 23. So then that's interesting in the light of how far, if the Jags do trade back, where, because then are you losing on your first round talent possibilities? And granted, you can still obviously land really good players in the second round, but he was pretty much like, once you're at the end of the first or once you're at the end of the second, you're picking already kind of guys that are more so that next round level guys. And so I feel like if you trade back, it's scary, because you're kind of watching everybody that we've been talking about and like possibly being going off the board. Again, it doesn't mean they can't land a player that would automatically be able to come in here and start and make a change. But I think for me, if you're not picking at 17, I would hope it was sooner then.
To further quantify that number, John Lynch, the general manager of the San Francisco 49ers, who I have now called out twice today on 1010XL and 92.5 FM, put 83 draftable grades on players this year. Of the hundreds of potential selections across 7 rounds, the 49ers have put 83 draftable grades with 22 first-round grades given out across all positions. So if you're looking for a number, and we don't have the Jaguars in front of us, unfortunately, I was not there Thursday, wasn't able to ask. Not sure Trent Baalke would have answered either way, but John Lynch did answer San Francisco media yesterday and said 22 first-round grades, which is a sizable number because, to your point, Taylor, Coach Campo says it all the time, there's a good chance that once you get past the first 14 or 15 guys, you feel like there's that big clump of 40 guys who have similar second, third-round grades, mm-hmm. and you're still being forced to pick them in the first round.
And that's where I wish we could see everyone's boards and see how drastically different it is from here to the West Coast, to the Northeast, to, you know,
based
all
on
over
scheme,
the country.
Based
right,
on
based off of everything, yeah. And to me, Taylor, you basically at this point have two camps, mm-hmm. I think. You've got the corner, please draft a corner camp, and then you've got the please move up and get a wide receiver. Mm-hmm. Because now people, if the once the talk of moving up to get a receiver, now it almost seems like people are like, don't get Brian Thomas. You've got to go get one of those top three.
You're like, wait, we can get one of the other ones?
Exactly.
Why haven't we been talking about that
in front of us? Right, exactly. Now, you've done a lot of research on those guys, but most people have been convinced that there's no chance the Jaguars can get Neighbors or Harrison or Odunze.
Yeah, and I think mainly just because of the history of Trent, and it's been more so a trade back or a stay for him than it has been a trade up, especially for an offensive weapon. So I think that kind of has lingered around what he's done in the past and what the Jags have done in the past in general, and I think that when you look at that, it's a whole conversation of, okay, that's historical things that don't relate to the group of men that are running the team right now here. But historically, the Jags have not taken or traded up for a wide receiver, and they have not taken a ton of wide receivers in the first round. And when they have, it didn't go very well. So there's always that little lingering in the back of your head of, okay, well, does that change this time? And then the fact of, do they actually trade up and do it? But also, can they finally land one that works?
Right. And yet here's the thing. We had Angela Morian of Wish TV out in Indianapolis on yesterday, right? And she said the one thing she would take to the bank is Chris Ballard never trades up. Yet you have Peter Schrager of the NFL Network, who has known Chris Ballard for decades, and plenty of other insiders who are saying, oh, they may be the team that trades up into the top 10. He has never done that before in his how many years as the GM of Indianapolis. But we are to suggest that he could change his stripes, but Trent Baalke can't change his traditions and his perceived notions of how he operates in the NFL draft. That's what I find fascinating, that we're like, oh, Chris Ballard could reinvent himself, but Trent can't.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why?
And I think that all of the GMs right now in the AFC South are probably all looking at each other like, this is a pretty competitive division, it looks like. And we saw what happened last year. And maybe more so some of those teams also, just as the Jags thought and just as we thought, where it thought there was going to be a little more of that in-between time before they were hitting that next level. And so maybe they're more so looking at it like, no, we could also compete right now in the AFC South pretty easily if you add one of these top receivers, or if you add, you know, whatever their kind of main thing is. And it looks like most people who want to trade up want to get Neighbors or Marvin Harrison or Odunze. But it seems like this year, and especially with this division, people are kind of looking at each other. It's like that Spider-Man meme of like all pointing fingers of like, oh, we could actually make this really fun. It doesn't have to be the Jags division or the Texans division, you know?
Right, and like Angela said yesterday, she would put the Colts in second behind the Texans. And I think if you went to Nashville, Titans fans would probably put themselves second behind the Texans. And Jags fans, some obviously would even say, no, the Jags are better than the Texans. Mm-hmm. The Texans had, one great year with C.J. Stroud. And, yes, they made some great additions in Danielle Hunter and Stephon Diggs. But the Jags are still going to be better. You know, we've got Trevor and all that stuff. I think most people nationally would put, obviously, the Texans won because they just won the division. And like I just mentioned, those additions they made in free agency. And then they'd probably have that Colts. I'm going to say they're probably going to agree with Angela if you look around nationally. Yeah. And then the Jags, but it could flip-flop. It just depends on what people think of obviously Trevor and this team. And then the Titans would be in that. We have no idea about Will Levis.
Yeah.
But people also don't really know about Anthony Richardson. And so that's where I would have the Jags probably more like second. Even though, you know, at this point in time, there's still so much to be determined with the NFL draft, which, of course, we cannot wait for it to actually start.
Well, and that's one thing I think that also shot up the Texans had a really good draft last year. And that, so you can see how quickly and drastically things can change just from the draft. We talk about free agency, and those are kind of guys that are set and, you know, and you've seen them in the NFL. But then when you look at the draft, if you can nail 2, 3, 4 picks in the draft, it could change your team pretty quickly.
Yeah, it certainly can. And momentarily, we're going to check in with Greg Bell from the Seattle Seahawks, the News Tribune out there in Seattle. I think we have Greg with us now. So hello, Greg. How are you?
Ladies, how's Jacksonville doing?
We are fantastic. Thanks. Just awaiting the draft, like I'm sure everyone else is that covers the NFL around the league. But, of course, we're going to zoom in on what we think the Seahawks might do with pick 16. But first, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the new head coach, Mike McDonald, taking over after Pete Carroll was the head coach there for 14 years.
Well, it's way different. I mean, Pete Carroll was one of one in the personality and the bonds he had. And the players are already saying that Mike McDonald, after 2 weeks of team meetings, is much more blunt. Blunt's the word I've heard from more than one player. Very to the point, direct. There's going to be an adjustment period here for a while. I mean, 14 years of Pete Carroll doing it one way. Mike McDonald's coming in, especially on defense, with a really no-nonsense, we have to fix this approach. And there's going to be – for the guys that have been here a couple of days, it's going to be an adjustment that may take into the season for sure.
Greg, excited to dive into everything that is Seahawks and how they will approach this week's draft. But we welcomed you on, and we forgot to give you the special liner as we count down to that all-important 17th overall pick.
Let's ring up another guest on the All-Pro Roofing phone line.
Ready? In 3, 2, 1.
The countdown to the draft is on.
I hope you're ready.
Who'll be off the board when the Jaguars pick? Let's find out.
We had to give you a little flair for the dramatic,
yeah.
Greg Bell, of course.
My day is complete now.
Exactly. And now it'll be even more complete because I get to say the dramatic words. With the 16th overall pick in the 2024 NFL Draft, whether it's a player or a position, Greg Bell believes the Seattle Seahawks will be selecting
Troy Fatanu, offensive tackle, Washington.
And there it is. Yep. Now, let's dive into it. He's been one of my favorite prospects throughout this process. Truly wished from the onset that the Jaguars may be able to finagle their offensive line to trend younger and go with the star tackle slash guard, depending on what your projection is for him at the next level out of the University of Washington. There's obviously familiarity with Ryan Grubb, now the offense coordinator of the Seahawks, Greg. But what is it about Fatanu that makes this such a slam dunk pick?
Well, you just nailed it by saying he's a tackle slash guard. I've had some NFL personnel people tell me he can start in the NFL at all five positions,
wow,
including center, on both sides of the line of guard and tackle. Not only is Ryan Grubb, the offensive coordinator, familiar with Troy Fatanu and coached him at Washington, the Seahawks also hired the Washington Huskies offensive line coach, Scott Huff. So it is part and parcel of the offense is the Washington Huskies offense. And not the Washington Huskies offense a couple of years ago, but just a couple of months ago that went to the national championship game that Fatanu and Penix played. And, of course, for now the Seahawks play caller and offensive line coach. If Michael Penix is at 16, I think they're going to take him. I don't think he's going to get past the Raiders at 12. And that's why the Seahawks would take Fatanu. It's equally likely, ladies, that the Seahawks trade down.
Okay.
John Schneider has done that 10 times in the last 12 years. He's traded his original first-round pick. The Seahawks don't have a second-round pick. There are multiple teams, such as the GM out here, John Schneider's buddies in Green Bay, Philadelphia, Carolina, Washington, that have multiple second-round picks and picks lower in the first round the Seahawks could trade with. I think they're going to try to trade down. Fatanu would give them pause before they do. If he's still around, which is an if because of his versatility, they need their offensive line in particular. Their guards and center have been a problem for a decade. They just lost Damian Lewis to a $53 million free agent deal to Carolina. It was way too rich for the Seahawks to compete for their starting left tackle or starting left guard the last few seasons. Their starting right guard last year, Phil Haynes, is currently unsigned and was beset by injuries. They have a rookie, Anthony Bradford. It was a rookie last year from LSU who started a couple games but is unproven. And they've had nine different centers in 9 years here since they traded Max Unger for Jimmy Graham a decade ago. So the interior of the offensive line is priority one. Fatanu could fix three positions at once.
Yeah, Greg, it's funny because we were just talking right before we had you on about the trends of GMs and whether they trade up and whether they don't have a history of trading up or down or whichever way, because we're kind of having the same conversation here in Jacksonville. But let's talk. You mentioned quarterback for a second. Let's look at that QB situation in Seattle. A couple seasons ago, we saw Geno Smith kind of have a bit of a resurgence, got a contract. People were actually pretty excited for him because it was something that came out of nowhere, and there was a lot of criticism when Seattle did make that trade. Things came back down to earth a little bit last season, but he still had a pretty decent year. What are the thoughts on him around Seattle right now?
that he's got pretty much one more season for sure. He's under contract for two, but there's almost no guaranteed money next year. And they traded for Sam Howell, of course, started at Washington last year to be the backup. And Howell is also under contract through 2025. Sam Howell is basically what Drew Lock was a couple of years ago. And then Drew Lock signed a $5 million free agent deal with the Giants, and the Seahawks said no thanks to that. So they got Howell. Geno Smith was going to regress last year. He threw for over 4,000 yards and broke four of Russell Wilson's team records his first year as a starter. Mm-hmm. It was not realistic to expect he would do that yet again. I think he's part of the solution and not the problem out here in Seattle. The offensive line has not always been there for him in pass protection. Kenneth Walker's been banged up as the running back that Smith needs to really be good and balanced. And the defense was just putrid last year. 31st against the run, 30th overall. It actually got worse than from when it was really bad the year before, and that's why Pete Carroll got fired. So if Geno Smith can be what he's been the last 2 years, and the Seahawks can be just serviceable on defense and have an offensive line that can at least give him some time, they've got what they need weapons-wise, DK Metcalf, Tyler Lockett, Jackson Smith and Jigba, Kenneth Walker running the ball, that Smith can excel again. But he's going to be 35 this year. His contract runs out after 2025, as I mentioned, with no guaranteed money next year. He's not the quarterback of the future, and that's what drafts are for.
Yeah, certainly that is what drafts are for. Greg Bell is with us talking all things Seahawks, and I appreciate you joining us because I'm sure it's in the morning over there. Greg, as far as the defense you just mentioned, it was your word was putrid. How difficult is that for Seahawks fans when they've been known to have such a stellar defense for so many years?
Yeah, it was flat embarrassing. Especially when the coach that you gave the keys to the franchise to 14 years ago is all about defense and the Legion of Boom and Bobby Wagner, who was back last year in the second go-around with the Seahawks and has since signed with the Commanders and his former Seahawks defensive coordinator Dan Quinn in Washington. It was embarrassing. It was a slap in Pete Carroll's face. Pete Carroll changed his scheme that he had run since the 1970s last year and went to a more Vic Fangio 3-4 hybrid type of scheme, and it failed. They didn't have a big enough defensive line to stop the run inside. They let Al Woods go and sign to the New York Jets, and they missed the big, big beef in front, which has some people thinking that they're going to draft guys like Sabandre Sweat from Texas, 366-pound defensive tackle in this draft, maybe in this later round, second, third day. But they have to get better at the line of scrimmage, or they're never going to compete with the 49ers out here in the NFC West. And if they don't compete with the 49ers, they're not going anywhere because they're not going to win the division, which means you don't get home playoff games, which means you're likely not going to go to the Super Bowl. Job one is to be better on both the offensive and defensive lines inside to compete with San Francisco. That's why the Fatano pick makes sense. Then they probably will go defensive line. They did bring back Leonard Williams as their big free agency signing to keep him from leaving. They gave him a $64 million deal and used most of their salary cap space on him. But when they traded with the Giants to get him, that cost them a second-round pick that I think they're going to recoup and then trade down in the first round on Thursday. There are just a lot of holes for a team that missed the playoffs for only the third time in 12 years last year. Having said all of this, it's not like they're starting over or that they were a 2-15 team last year. They've had 9 wins in consecutive seasons, which is mediocre, but not something that you're going to blow it all up. They're blowing it all up on defense, though. But they had the pieces on offense to still compete and potentially with a better defense get to 10 wins.
That's a wild stat. I think it bears repeating. The Seahawks last year missed the postseason, Greg, for only the third time in 12 years.
Yeah, we try to tell people. I mean, Jacksonville would probably take that.
Yeah, I think so.
100%.
I know Cleveland would take that.
Yeah, the Jags have made the postseason 3 times in 12 years. And so I think maybe it gives Seahawks fans a little bit more perspective looking outside of the Pacific Northwest and where some other teams find themselves. But
I try to tell that. I host a radio show at 10 to 12 here in Seattle. I try to tell people that all the time, that it ain't like this everywhere. People are just like, the Seahawks are trash. They should put over it, but all that.
Hey, listen, you know, they understand how quickly this league can turn and why the NFL draft is so important, why getting that head coaching position is oh so important. And Greg, before we let you go, we actually have a question for you from one of our listeners off the text line designed by Lifetime Enclosures regarding DK Metcalf, regarding Tyler Lockett, knowing that both those players are certainly in their prime or the second half of their career, if you may. Could they be on the trade block if Mike McDonald is to also want to remake the offensive side of the ball in his own liking?
The only way I could see that is if they go all in Taylor on one of the top three quarterbacks and trade up to the top five and trade and use DK Metcalf. They don't have the draft capital to move up. So unless they've decided that it really is just 1 year for Geno Smith and they have no intention of testing Sam Howell as the future quarterback, and they're going to trade up to the top five to get one of those guys, then yes, that would be the one chip they could use. Metcalf's contract is extremely large, second highest cap number on the team, kind of Geno Smith, and it ends after next year. I'm of the belief the Seahawks should build around Geno Smith because they are going to have a new quarterback after 2025. Make Metcalf, re-sign him. It's going to take $100 million to do it, but the cap is going up. And if you draft a young quarterback this year, maybe next year, then if that quarterback's not going to pick up the salary cap space that you can then devote to re-signing Metcalf. Lockett's a different deal. He's said, almost flat out said, I'm not playing for that much. He has said, I'm not playing for that much longer. This could be his last season at age 32. He's also under contract for next year in a contract that's really cuttable and be able to be renegotiated. He renegotiated his deal this year. But he's got a lot going on outside of football. He's a real estate agent. He does a lot of work in philanthropy and community service back in his hometown of Tulsa, Oklahoma. He does spoken word. He just got married. There's a lot going on that he wants to move on behind football, and it wouldn't surprise me if this is Tyler Lockett's last season.
Man, this is some fascinating stuff. I mean, I thought the stat about three times in 12 years not making the postseason was fascinating enough. Now we hear about Tyler Lockett and spoken word and a real estate license. I think more NFL players need to follow his lead, Greg.
Yeah, he's got more going on than football. He doesn't need the football paycheck to succeed. He's got million-dollar real estate deals by the week in three states. He's just got license in his third state. He's got some stuff going on. He doesn't need to play and bash his head in forever.
He's not just out here like flipping little fixer-uppers or anything like that.
We're
talking commercial real estate.
No, we're talking oceanside mansions in the Pacific Ocean out here. Yeah,
casual.
He doesn't waste his time.
Casual. He is Greg Bell, and you can find him on X at GBell Seattle, and he has selected Troy Fatanu in our countdown to 17 for the Seattle Seahawks, selecting as of now at 16th overall in this week's NFL draft. Greg, thanks so much for joining us on the All-Pro Roofing Hotline.
Thanks, Taylor. Enjoy the draft. Have a good week.
There he goes again, Greg Bell. You can find him at GBell Seattle on X. Some real fascinating stuff. I didn't even realize, number one, that Tyler Lockett was 32. Number two, that, yes, he's a realtor and has all these other interests. Mm-hmm. But also that there is this world behind the curtain for the Seahawks in which they have Metcalf and Lockett under contract for another year or two. You know Geno's contract all but runs out after 2 years from now. I mean, we could say after this season if we want, because it really was a two-year deal when he signed that three-year deal now over a year ago. But it's fascinating because we know that there was some consideration from the Seahawks camp in Anthony Richardson last NFL draft. Mm-hmm. They really, I mean, perhaps have done some homework on the quarterback crop this year, but not to the extent they did last year. But at some point in time, they're going to have to draw a line in the sand on offense as well.
It is their situation's interesting because you have Lockett heading into year 10, DK heading into year 6, I believe. And then they also, it looks like they just hit on Jaxon Smith-Njigba too. So they've had just like a decade of receivers that they haven't really had to worry a whole lot about, especially once they had that DK Tyler Lockett combination. It's just something they really haven't had to think about. And now maybe you're getting to that point where you do have to think about it again.
They didn't have to think about head coach and Pete Carroll. They didn't have to think about quarterback for a long time. Yeah. And Russell Wilson, obviously the defensive front he talked about as far as Legion of Boom too, the middle linebackers and all that stuff. Like they've had success, sustained success for so long. And now they're in a different world, which is why, fans think he said the words that they're trash. From the outside looking in, you don't think that. But you know, if you don't have a franchise quarterback, everyone's going to think that about the football team. All right, when we come back, we will be joined by Coach Corey Parker. He is the cornerbacks coach at the University of Toledo. So we're going to chat all things Quinyon Mitchell. That's next on Helmets and Heels on 10 to Next on 92.5 FM.
Let's ring up another guest on the All-Pro Roofing phone line.
This is Helmets and Heels.
Kept classy by First Coast Lighting and Fans. Upscale lighting, fans, and home decor.
On 1010XL.
All right, welcome back or welcome in if you are just joining us. We have a very special guest with us right now, a name that has been talked about a whole lot here in Jacksonville, as now we're just a couple days from the draft. We are joined by Coach Corey Parker. He's the cornerbacks coach for Toledo. Coach, thank you so much for hopping on with us.
Oh, definitely. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here and talk with you guys a little bit about my guy, Quinyon.
Yeah, so that's why we're here. In your bio, it says, in the first sentence, that you mentored Quinyon Mitchell to multiple All-American honors and a first-team All-MAC. So let's start there, Coach, with that mentorship and how that relationship first formed when you arrived there at Toledo.
The relationship formed with just a true language of love and honesty. Like, he was able to articulate to me in a one-on-one meeting what he expected of me as a coach. And I'm crazy enough as a coach to ask that question to my players. Like, what's your expectations of you? What do you want from me to make you the best version of you? And he looked at me in the eyes and he said, I want you to coach me hard every day. Don't let up on nothing on me, coach. Like, coach me hard, make me the best. And I said, that's all you asking from me. He said, yes, sir. Because he's a very quiet, reserved guy when it comes to those type of interactions. He's a yes, sir, no, ma'am, yes, ma'am type of person. That's how he was raised by his grandma and his mom. And I love that about him because that's his sense of honesty. He was honest with me in that moment. And I was able to look and smile. And I knew, oh, I'm cooking hot grease today, baby. Because as an old high school head coach, like, I love the moment of being able to coach a kid hard with love and with passion and with transparency, without worrying about ruffling any feathers. You know what I mean? Because nowadays you have some kids that cannot, they can't take someone that is giving it to them direct. They want everything sugar-coated sometimes. And it just speaks to the way he was raised and who he is as a man that allowed me to really help him grow and help mentor him, because I could do it without worrying about if I say something to him that he may not agree with, how is he going to respond? I didn't have to worry about that. All I had to worry about was being honest with him and telling him, no, Q, you got to fix this. No, Q, put your eyes here. No, Q, try this, try that. And after a while, I didn't have to say that anymore. He was telling that to the younger guys inside of the program. The same thing I was coaching him on, he was ready to coach the young guys on how to do better. And so that told me right then and there. Like I said, once again, I'm cooking hot grease. And that fish is going to be real good when I pull it out of the skillet. Because, you know, when you got a guy that listens like that and is able to articulate that message to his peers, oh, man, that's something special in coaching.
And Corey, I think I don't want to make, you know, assumptions here, but I would assume that part of that mentality of I need to be coached, I need to not have frills, is because Quinyon was largely overlooked coming out of Williston, Florida, down the road from us, you know, a 2-3-star recruit, ends up at Toledo. Walk us through how he ends up at Toledo and perhaps that 2-star, but I play like a 5-star mentality.
Well, Coach Jason Kando, Coach Hank Potey, Coach Ricky Ciccone, they all did a fantastic job identifying Quinyon as a guy that could project, as a projection, become a great cornerback, because he showed so many great skills as a running back with the ball and doing some things for Williston High School that ultimately it was a true projection. And that's something that Jason Kando has a very, very good eye with, you know, going back to Pierre Garcon and who he coached at Mountain Union. He has a great eye of identifying talent and ability and high level ability. So when Quinyon got to Toledo, obviously it was just that developmental piece that started with Coach Brad Bechet and what he was able to do with him in the weight room, in the speed department. Whereas now you're talking about a dude that probably got to school at somewhere around 170, 180 pounds. This dude is 190, pounds and can bench 225, 20 reps and run a 4.340 and does it with a level of intensity, but with a chip on his shoulder because he's still pissed about the way that he was treated through recruiting by other schools. So he takes that attack out on the field with him every single day at practice and in games versus opponents to let everybody know, you made a mistake by looking over me, and I'm going to carry it with me until, you know, until I retire. And that's pretty much how he carries himself.
And we love that. So 5 interceptions 2 seasons ago for Quinyon, just 1 this past year. Did that bother him?
No, it didn't bother him at all because, you know, we came into this season the same way I had that assessment with him when I got here in 2022. I had another assessment with him this past offseason, and it was 100% about understanding, hey, bro, listen, you know, any coach, offensive coordinator, or quarterback that throws your way this year is just plain and simple crazy. So statistically, you may not have some of the gaudy stats that you had last year. So we're going to evaluate you off of very small, fine, new details that is going to take to help get you to the next level. So we're not even worried about this year. Yes, you're going to be great this year because I'm going to hold you to that standard. But let's push you to how many times you have bad eye discipline errors inside of scramble downs. So when the quarterback starts scrambling around, are you looking back to QB? Are you looking through your man? Because when you do that, that's going to create another pass breakup. May not have been an interception, but a pass breakup. And so he lived in that moment of being a very fine, detailed guy and really trying to manage his eyes well through watching film, through being a master of the game of football and studying and studying and studying so that we weren't worried about that. We're worried about winning. We're worried about helping his team do the best that they can, ultimately helping the defense do the best they can. So he transitioned his game from, you know, most kids will be selfish and it just, oh, man, what about me? I didn't get off, so I'm pissed off. No, it was 100% the opposite. We got to win. How many overthrows did you create, Q? It may not have been a pick or a PB, but how many overthrows did you create? How many quarterback sacks did you create because you locked down the quarterback's initial read, right? Or quarterback hurry. How many of those did we call? So we started detailing the smaller, finute things that may happen at the next level rather than at the college level. Different things happen, but we were focused on the things that we need to see happen. And ultimately, that drove him to be even better and want more and learn more about the game and how he can impose his will on the game without even having a stat, quote-unquote, in the stat book.
Look, and we're joined by Coach Corey Parker, cornerback coach for Toledo. We're talking about Quinyon Mitchell. And when you all of that looks like it paid off, when you look at it, the statistics, and I know stats aren't everything, but Mitchell put some of the best advanced coverage metrics PFF era has ever recorded over a 2 sample size period and a period of time. And now it looks like he's going to be the first MAC defensive back selected in the first round since Jimmy Ward, who, by the way, was picked by Trent Baalke in 2014. Trent Baalke is now the GM of the Jacksonville Jaguars, so it feels like lines are aligning a little bit. But, Coach, before we let you go, just tell us real quick what that kind of shows and highlights for the MAC conference and for Toledo.
Oh, I think for Toledo it's awesome because, you know, our coaches do a great job with our players, and our players do a great job of taking the coaching and performing well on the field. I think for the MAC has been doing it for a long time, putting out great players. You're talking about Ben Roethlisberger. You're talking about Greg Jennings. You're talking about Michael the Burner Turner. You're talking about Garrett Wolf. You're talking about guys that came into the NFL and have had, you know, tremendous careers, not just getting picked. And that's where we're at with Q. It's not about getting picked, bro. Like, it's about getting in this thing and delivering an impact, whether it's on special teams and blocking punts or running down the field and covering as a gunner, in addition to doing what you do as a defensive back. So it's just trying to create a lifelong journey and trying to create a legacy and make sure at the end of the day, that last name of Mitchell means something, and it means something in the whole state of Florida, not just Williston. So just trying to continuously, see how this thing goes and how he grows. At the end of the day, he's already, you know, defeated the odds by, you know, fighting his way through adversity and tough times and making himself, you know, a recruitable player for the college level and also a draftable player now right here in the NFL draft. So I'm so excited for him and his family and thankful that he allowed me to coach him and really become a family member to him.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Coach Parker. Again, Corey Parker, the cornerbacks coach at the University of Toledo. You can find him on X at Coach C. Parker. I will tell you this, my friend. I've had multiple friends reach out, not only on our text line here at the station, but on my personal cell phone. They absolutely love the enthusiasm that you ooze. And, of course, we will be rooting for Quinyon this week on draft night.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Let's all root them on. And any way I can ever help anybody, please let me know. It's a language of love. A lot of people help me, so I got to help others. Passing it down.
That is Corey Parker, the defensive pass game coordinator and cornerbacks coach at the University of Toledo. And from a defensive backs coach, we head down to Tallytown. RJ, let's hit it.
Let's ring up another guest on the All-Pro Roofing phone line.
This guy's playing defense in a different light, Lauren. I had to get that out there as we welcome on our next guest, Ira Shafel of Warchant.com. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm great. How are y'all?
Doing great. I know we were supposed to have you yesterday, but the defense would not rest. I think that's the right legal term when it comes to Florida State and its case against the ACC. Maybe, possibly. I didn't go to law school. Walk us through exactly what is going down over in Tallahassee / the court system throughout the Southeast regarding the Atlantic Coast Conference.
Yeah, I feel like we should use the Law and Order theme music to start the segment. But
my mom
yeah,
gave me flack that I never went to law school, despite spending like 7 years in college towns, Ira. So we're going to go off of whatever we learned from Law and Order.
Sounds good. Yeah, so there's two separate lawsuits related to FSU and the ACC. FSU is suing the ACC in Florida, basically trying to get the grant of rights ruled getting the court to decide that the grant of rights doesn't apply, and that also so they can get their TV rights back, and also that they shouldn't have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to get out of the ACC. The ACC is suing Florida State up in North Carolina to basically for breach of contract and some other motions as well. So you have two separate cases going on. What happened down here yesterday was the ACC filed a motion to dismiss the case in Florida, saying that this is a case that should be heard in North Carolina, that Florida doesn't have jurisdiction on that case. It seemed like it was going to go in Florida State's favor until kind of the end. The ACC made an argument basically on a technicality about how FSU worded their complaint against the ACC, that they weren't explicit enough explaining exactly from a legal standpoint why that case should be heard in Florida. So the judge ruled that basically he granted their motion to dismiss pending FSU filing a new document. So he's not going to dismiss Florida State's case. I think that's going to end up going forward. But right now, Florida State has to resubmit their paperwork. And then it's basically about a month delay, I think, overall. At that point, I think FSU's case will continue to move forward against the ACC.
Ira Shafel, managing editor of Warchant.com with us. All right, let's go from the courtroom to the football field. The spring showcase was this past weekend, Ira, and DJ Uiagalelei gave people reasons to be excited, but also a little bit of reason to pause as well. Jordan Travis there on the sidelines, that was fun to see. But how are you feeling about DJU right now?
I like DJ, and I think he's going to have a good year. That wasn't his best day of the spring. I thought the last couple weeks in practices, he looked really good. And I think there was a combination of things that happened in that spring game. One is, you know, I think you have a lot of players probably maybe pressing a little bit because it's their first time in front of the fans. It's a very new team with a whole bunch of new skill players and obviously a new quarterback. And then also the defense played really well. And I also think at the end of the spring, the defense kind of knows what the offense is running. So I think you had a lot of plays where there really wasn't a lot open. So it looked like DJ forced a couple throws. But honestly, I think that was because there was nothing open. And the FSU's defense really had a good idea of what the offense was going to be running. I think he's looked really good in practice. I think Mike Norvell is going to be really good for him. And, you know, to me, the bigger concern right now is what we saw in that spring game is the receivers didn't make a lot of plays. And that's more concerning to me. I think the guy needs a little, maybe another weapon or two if they can get in the transfer portal, or maybe some of these other guys will develop over the next 4 months. But I'm a little bit more concerned about the guys on the other end of DJ's passes than I am DJ.
Ira, one of the things that were noted from the spring game, Norvell kind of, he said it was a showcase, not a game. There were certain levels of some intensity levels that seemed a little high, so much so where we saw a few injuries, including Malik Benson. What do we know about that?
Yeah, it sounds like he's going to be okay. I don't know, you know, how many weeks he might be out or anything like that, but it's not anything, from what I'm being told, it's not anything that's going to affect him in the 2024 season. And that's a big deal because, he's the Alabama transfer has been, I think, FSU's best receiver for most of the spring. And you saw him make a great catch earlier in that showcase. So I think he'll be their number one receiver this fall unless they go out and get somebody like a Keon Coleman again like they did last year. And it's great news that it sounds like he's going to be okay.
Ira, before we let you go on the All-Pro Roofing Hotline, do want to look ahead to the NFL draft this week. 13, I believe it's up to 13 guys who are at the Combine representing Florida State who could be drafted over the course of this weekend. I'm curious, obviously you're focused on the Noles who are in Tallahassee, who are on campus as well as that ongoing lawsuit, but what are your expectations when it comes to where a Jordan Travis may be selected, where Keon Coleman, where Johnny Wilson could be picked this weekend?
I really think there's a lot of variables there with some of those guys. You know, Jared Verse is probably the only one who's a surefire first rounder, and then Braden Fisk might be maybe some talk of late first round or definitely second round. But after that, I think a lot of those guys, it's going to be dependent on which teams fall in love with them. You know, I think because each of them, I think, has a reason why you should really like them. And then I also think there's a reason why you might be a suspect. Johnny Wilson obviously ran great at the combine. He's 6'7". He's had some consistency issues as a pass catcher. Keon Coleman did not run real well at the combine, but he's a super productive player and makes great plays on the field. So, and then Jordan Travis is a guy who I think, you know, knowing that he's coming back from the injury, he hasn't been able to work out for teams. So that's a challenge. But I think, you know, teams that have talked to him, I think have come away really impressed and what he knows when he gets on the whiteboard and things like that. So my guess is, you know, Johnny and I think Keon will probably be the third pick after Braden Fisk and Jared Verse. And then I think Johnny will come after him. And then I think Jordan might be, you know, maybe fifth or sixth round. Some people have said seventh round, but I have a feeling he might go a little higher than some people think.
Yeah, I heard from at least one scout that they have a third round grade on Jordan Travis. And wouldn't that be something? One other name I really want to get your take on, Ira, before we let you go. Renardo Green has been this sneaky, under-the-radar name, especially for defenses like the Jaguars that are expected to move to more of a press man coverage system. What would he bring to an NFL team, perhaps one here in Duval County?
I think he would fit in perfect with that. He's a very physical corner. He's very athletic. He's a guy that, you know, earlier in his career, they couldn't find a home for him. They played him at safety. They played him at corner. He dealt with some injuries. But the last 2 years, he really played exceptionally. He's as good a cornerback as Florida State's had in several years, probably going back to those championship teams. Well, I mean, Asante Samuel was really good too. But he played a great corner the last couple of years. Physical kid, will come up and hit, can play and run support. And I also think he's very mature. That's one thing I like about Renardo Green. He's not, you know, when the NIL money started pouring in for some of these kids, Renardo Green was still driving a very conservative car. I think, you know, just he's got a business-like approach, and I think he's going to be a good pro.
Speaking of DBs, by the way, Zaire Thomas, known as AZ, I heard EJ Manuel on the broadcast reference Jalen Ramsey and talking about him. He's a guy I feel like people need to be paying attention to.
I agree 100%. He is, and the Jalen Ramsey comparisons are going to be obvious because, well, he's wearing number 8 now, which Jalen had worn, and he's also, you know, just the length and the ranginess of him. The only difference I would say is Jalen has that, and you guys know it well, Jalen's got that temperament, it's a nastiness about him. I haven't seen that nastiness maybe out of Azari, but he's got tremendous physical talent, and he's going to be, he might be their best player on defense this fall. I think he's going to have a great season.
All right, Ira, we really appreciate your time. We know you have a show to get to, so thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Anytime. Take care.
Absolutely. It was so strange, by the way, watching that spring game and their spring showcase and seeing Doak Campbell the way it's been, you know, basically.
You mean that it looked like what Vanderbilt looked like when we were there for SEC Media Days and also their first three games of the season when they had to change, like, in a friggin', what do you call it?
Like, porta
potty. A trailer, yeah, a trailer. And then there was a lightning delay, and not quite that level of
Doak
Campbell.
Half demolished, though, for real.
I will say real quick, since we were on this, because Tom Pelissero just tweeted, one name to watch, Florida State wide receiver Keon Coleman, who quietly was among the busiest players during the pre-draft process with a dozen visits plus a couple private team workouts.
There you go. Yeah, it'll be so fun to watch the Florida State guys and where they get drafted over the Thursday, Friday, and Saturday that is later this week. We've got a giveaway when we return. You are listening to Helmets and Heels on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Helmets and Heels is switched on by
First Coast Lighting and Fans.
Upscale lighting, fans, and home decor on 1010XL.
All right, for all you AEW fans out there, tomorrow night at Daly's Place, AEW Dynamite. Begins at 7:30. If you want to go, be caller number 4-641-1010. Call number 4-641-1010. You are going to AEW Dynamite tomorrow night, 7:30 at Daly's Place. All right, when we return, we've got our heels highlights, and we're going to go around the sports world as well. I've also, for you ladies, got a Scottie Scheffler fun fact, so we will do that. When we return, you are listening to Helmets and Heels on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
Light up your lunch with Helmets and Heels.
Presented by First Coast Lighting and Fans.
On 1010XL.
Thanks to all of our guests, by the way, today. Greg Bell talking Seahawks and what they might do with the 16th pick. Sounds like tackle to me. Thanks to Coach Corey Parker, defensive pass game coordinator and cornerbacks coach at the University of Toledo, talking all things Quinyon Mitchell. And Irish O'Fell talking all things FSU. By the way, if you miss any of those, you can, of course, find them on demand. Corey Parker has so much energy. Taylor, we were just talking about this in the break. Like, you hear him talking and you're like, I want to play for that guy. Like, he loves his players. He is passionate. He is super knowledgeable, and I love that he talked about that. Like, I'm a crazy coach. I actually ask the players what they want from me. Mm-hmm. Not every coach does that. So, yeah, he was a great guy.
Yeah, he's great. And I was saying, too, on break, you can always tell because that's pretty much, like, the gist of what Making Monsters is talking to high school coach and college coaches and kind of getting their thought of how that player got there and his, you know, transformation through his time at that, whether it's high school or college. And you can always tell, like, the coaches support their guys and love their guys. But there's certain times when it's just, like, an extra level of you can tell they – genuinely care, genuinely just have all of the love and respect and everything you could possibly ask for from a coach for certain players. And you could feel that a lot with Coach Parker and Quinyon.
Yeah, and he did tell us, if you want to follow him, at Coach C. Parker on X. I already got some texts that some people have already followed him. So hopefully we get a little Toledo-Jacksonville pipeline, because I do think the point should be made again that Quinyon Mitchell, and we see this every draft year, but it's so fascinating when they're from just down the road, in this case, right outside of Gainesville and Williston, that, you know, he was a little thought of 2-3-star recruit who, as Coach Parker alluded to, arrived at about 170 pounds-ish and was able to transform himself into a top 15 draft pick.
Yeah.
And, of course, the conversation will rage on for the next 48-plus hours of whether his fit may be here in Jacksonville. But regardless, listen, hearing his story and what he was able to do over the past 3-4 years in Toledo, how could you not root for a kid like that?
Well, and there's a whole other level to it, too, because he had multiple chances to transfer at the time when he was at Toledo. A ton of offers from other schools, and you know kids a lot of times will just hit that right away if it's going to an SEC school or a Big Ten school or whatever it is. But he declined every single time and said, no, my ties are here in Toledo. And I think that adds a whole other level of just, like, commitment, because this is a school that gave him a chance when he wasn't, you know, highly starred the way that some people may feel like he should have. And so he gave his loyalty to Toledo. And I love those stories because it's like he definitely could have had the chance to go somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. You can always tie it back to a guy like Carson Beck, mm-hmm. who had to wait his turn at Georgia and certainly, I'm sure, had offers to go other places. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact he had offers to go other places and decided to stay with Georgia. And certainly he's not doing so poorly with the NIL deals that he has now. All right, let's get into this week's Heels highlights. RJ, take it away.
Hit me!
Florida's Jack Caglione ties NCAA record with home run in ninth straight game.
And he drives it high and deep to right field. And Jack Caglione with a record shot.
14-point lead lost in game one. 20-point lead lost in game two. The Lakers can't find a way to win, and I can't find my will to live.
Murray makes a move. Here's a
conversation between the umpire and Aaron Boone gets toxic.
You're not yelling at me. I did what I was supposed to do. I'm looking for him to get hit by the pitch. You got anything else to say? You're gone.
Okay? Oh, okay, Hunter. Wow.
Aaron,
there you go. And now Aaron's saying, I didn't
say anything.
The craziest finish in Knicks history got a Mike Breen double bang.
Hartenstein gets it out to Ananobi. DiVincenzo a three. Bang! Bang! Knicks take a one-point lead with 13 seconds remaining.
RJ, I need you to turn the live stream on because folks were just cheated out of your reaction to the Lakers subplot of two epic, I'll call them buzzer beaters in the NBA. Look, let's not bury the lead here on the basketball side of things. College basketball has been criticized over the past 5 years that it has dropped in terms of viewership, in terms of followership. It doesn't have stars. The NBA, so many people say, oh, we don't tune in until the playoffs, and even then it's all runaway. You had two games last night. For anybody who loves last-second finishes and teams that, quote-unquote, aren't perhaps the marquee names, or rather, should I say, the marquee names were the ones that got trumped last night. Sorry, RJ and the Lakers. I just think you're seeing such parity right now in the NBA and such great, great finishes over the first 2-3 days of the NBA playoffs. And then you get the Kevin Harlan and the Mike Breen calls, which are both epic, that we had to highlight them on Heels Highlights, regardless of RJ's feelings. Sorry, RJ.
RJ, you put in there, lost your will to live. Do we need to talk you off a ledge?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe. It's getting to that point. Every single time.
I said to you off air, RJ, like it's frustrating for you as a Lakers fan because you probably could have stolen both games in Denver over Saturday and last night, if not at least one of the two. At the same time, it's like so hard for me to like wrap my brain around who the Denver Nuggets are because it's largely the same outfit that won the NBA title last year. And I understand Nikola Jokic is the greatest player in the world right now, but it's not like it's a monster Golden State Warrior super team. They just are a group that Malone has them playing really well together once again at the right time. And that's no knock on the Lakers. I just think it's fascinating. And again, when I talk about parity in the NBA, I think that conversation has to begin and end with the Denver Nuggets, does it not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think when you look at this Denver Nuggets team, I believe that you have two superstar-type players and then a very great supporting cast around them. And I think that's really been the telltale sign of this series, where they can always depend on guys like Michael Porter Jr. or depend on guys such as Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. You have Reggie Jackson coming off the bench and being serviceable. You bring in the 100-year-old body of DeAndre Jordan, and he gives you serviceable minutes. You know, I talked to John Ireland a couple days ago, radio voice of the LA Lakers, and he said, you know, LA believes that they can beat this team. They felt that the last 15 games of the year, they haven't been playing like a 7 seed. And then you see how they play, where they have a 14-point lead in game one, a 20-point lead in game two, and you see that the run is coming from the Denver Nuggets. I think the Lakers kind of play a way where they're saying, well, they have to cool off at some point. And then the cool-off doesn't happen, and their role players now start to get scared. LeBron Bellis out, AD Bellis out. You just can't win that way, and they did this last year, so yeah, I expect an early vacation for LA.
I would also like to just give the Nuggets one more set of kudos. Sorry, RJ. Because I think you can relate it to the National Football League and this upcoming NFL draft. Credit to the Denver Nuggets because, and this is with no disrespect to the process in Philadelphia, when the Denver Nuggets selected Nikola Jokic, they knew he wasn't going to be a star day one. I would compare the Nuggets situation more to the Milwaukee Bucks than I would the process in Philadelphia. When they drafted Jamal Murray, they knew he was good at Kentucky. He is only the second player, I believe, in Coach Calipari's 14, 15 years at Kentucky to average 20-plus points per game, but he was on a loaded team. But they said, we're going to give you time. You're not expected to be a top-5 player in the NBA now. You certainly saw with Michael Porter Jr., who, of course, barely played at Mizzou because of the injuries he sustained. And then you have Christian Braun, who I don't think a lot of people expected his NBA career to have success so early on. But the point remains that in a world in which we expect quarterbacks to come into the NFL, get thrown into the fire almost immediately. Credit to the NBA and credit to that organization in particular, because they said, you know what, we're going to bring these guys in, and even if Nikola Jokic is now ascending to MVP level, we know it's still taking Michael Porter Jr. some time. We're not going to move on from him. We're going to let him develop, and maybe we're not winning NBA titles because he is still learning. We have these other two superstars who are also still learning, but they are ascending, and that's okay, as opposed to if we don't get exactly what we want from these guys right now, we need to move on. So,
Yeah, I feel like when every video I was seeing, that it goes beyond, obviously, there was the complete blow up on the court, but the frustration that is like bleeding into the after is usually an issue that lingers. And you saw Anthony Davis slam a microphone down in his post game. And it's just those moments where you feel like in the past, especially LeBron, he'd be good. Like, you know, calm down, next game,
cool head,
move on.
Yep.
It seems like blowing up on and off the court. Right?
And perhaps that's because of the structure and the system. And that's why I said to RJ, I'm like, the Nuggets are a machine. I don't know if I'd go as far as to say the Knicks are a machine. I just think the Knicks, Lauren, are they're quite frankly, they took the 2018 Villanova roster and they said, we're just going to bring it here and let Tibbs coach it. And that's literally what we're going to do. and it's working. So, I mean, that's one of my favorite college teams, regardless of sport, of all time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the run that they went on between 16 and 18 winning the national title, one of the more fun groups. You look back at that 2016 national title roster that Jay Wright had and you're like, wait, they literally had like 8 NBA guys. Oh yeah, they did, and half of them play for the Knicks now. Yeah. And anytime
they really, what do they have, 3?
Yeah, they have 3. I mean, they have Brunson, Hart, and Dante DiVincenzo, who, yes, is on my punchable face rankings for those of you who are wondering.
I like him.
I do too. I think Dante DiVincenzo
just want to punch him.
Yeah, he just has a punchable face. He's from Wisconsin. I mean, no, he's not
that
from,
makes sense.
He was drafted by Wisconsin, but by the Bucks, so he spent time there. So you know, then immediately gets a punchable face. But no, he's an interesting story, just because I think if not for that 2018 title run, I don't think he leaves for the draft. He's definitely not a lottery pick. And certainly his career has been a winding road to now, but now he's back with the same two guys that helped him and the Wildcats win 2 national titles in 3 years. And it's working. I don't want to curse Dan Hicken's Knicks. I'm not sure how long this magical run's going to last, but hey, can you find lightning in a bottle? Can lightning strike twice with the same group of guys?
What's crazy to me is how blatant the complaints about the officials are, whether it's in person in the postgame pressers or if it's on Twitter, and it seems like that would never fly in the NFL.
Yeah.
If players talking about the refs and everything like that. But talking about another sport where players definitely, and certainly a manager, want to complain about the officials would be your highlight, Taylor, with Aaron Boone getting ejected yesterday. I'm not a Yankees fan, so naturally I laughed when I saw it. I'm sure Yankees fans were very upset, but in case people missed it, a fan yelled something after Aaron was warned, and the ump thought that it was Aaron yelling it. It was not, but either way, he still got ejected.
It was, funny to me, too. I laughed. The whole situation's odd, but when you watch the video, it's just Aaron Boone's, like, pointing to the fan, like, it wasn't me.
It's like the classic, you're in the back of the van, you're in your mom's van.
Yeah.
And she tells the two kids, like, knock it off, one more thing, and, like, I am going to smack you, right? Maybe not in today's day and age. Back in my day, that was the threat. And so, like, you're going to get spanked. And so then, like, one kid touches the other. The brother touches the sister touches the brother. That one more thing that, like, just makes the mom fly off the handle. Yeah, she has to pull over to the side of the road and all that stuff. That's what it reminded me of.
And it's just, but it also, in the same breath, like, the issue with the umps is getting worse and worse as we go along. And I think part of that is now we do have mic'd up and you're catching what they're saying and you're seeing on video. Like, imagine if we didn't see Aaron Boone and him actually really not say anything, and it was just more of a, like, him saying the fan said it, but the ump said he said it, then we'd probably be like, Aaron Boone did it, you know? But now we have so much more coverage and we're getting the actual sound from the ump and from Aaron Boone, but it goes beyond. Like, there's just been so many games that have been truly dictated by the umpire screwing things up, and it's just, there's going to be a point where I was having a conversation with friends actually at the Iceman game, and they're big baseball fans, and they're like, are robot umps coming? Because it's just getting to the point where they're like, think they're like the umps rule the world, and they know they can really dictate games fully with certain things, and it's come to the point where you almost feel like they do it, like, facetiously sometimes.
Can we address what the fan said? The fan literally just said, let's go home plate. Let's go home plate was the straw that broke the camel's back.
The ump just thought Aaron Boone was talking back.
Right, and the Zapruder film, and shout out to John Boy Media, by the way. Taylor and I were cracking up before we came on the air, because Ryan Ruocco, who was calling the game on the YES Network, literally says, like, well, no John Boy breakdown required. We've got him up. We've got the ump mic'd up. We can hear everything he's saying. Mm-hmm. But there was indeed a John Boy Media breakdown that was required, because then, credit to the YES Network, they zoomed in. They got the fan. He took the video, was able to actually figure out what he was saying. And the fact that it was so harmless is, let's go home plate. Like, I'm sorry. This is one of those moments where I say, are you fit to be a Major League Baseball umpire if you can't take a little trash talking? Yeah. Whether it's from the manager or it's from the fan in the stands. Like, I'm sorry. I'm not calling him soft, but I'm calling him soft. Sorry, Hunter.
Well, it's just, yeah, it's crazy to me. His name is Hunter Wendelstedt. He, of course, had never been known by most people as of yesterday, and today everyone.
And I was about to say, imagine being him. World, you got no. Hunter. Injected.
Right. But, like, you're only five pitches into the game. Yeah. That's where it's also, like, you've got to have a little bit thicker of skin if you're going to be a Major League Baseball umpire. And then my highlight also, baseball-related, we talked about it yesterday, Caglione hit his home run in the ninth straight game. Didn't get it to 10 to break the record, but at least he was able to tie the record as Florida, like I said yesterday, just sits one game above 500 at 20-19. So going to be interesting. And oh, by the way, Florida plays host to Stetson tonight, but this weekend, second-ranked Arkansas.
Oh, fun.
Florida started the season in the SEC going up against top-ranked Texas A&M. Won that, but certainly things have changed since then. When it comes to... by the way, one other highlight as far as the elsewhere in the sports world, the Texans just released their new uniforms. It's their first time getting new uniforms since 2002. That they joined the Lions, the Broncos, and the Jets. Taylor, you tweeted about the Broncos uniforms yesterday, and I am not a uni person. Like, they don't make me super excited to wake up and see them, and I don't lose sleep over the fact if I hate them or if I dislike them. But to me, all of these just kind of look like they, yes, they're classics. And so I don't really understand why there would be outrage over some of these uniforms.
It's weird. There was a ton I saw about Denver. People were just absolutely smashing Denver and hating them. I remember the Jets, that happened to them a few seasons ago, too. They posted like their video just being like, here's our new uniforms. And people just like turned it into this entire joke. But there are some where sometimes I see it and I'm like, oh no, like that's not it. Like, I will tell you, I don't like the Houston helmet with the H. I think that's ugly. There are some though that I'm like, oh, I actually kind of like that. But the Denver ones to me were just like, there wasn't anything, it just kind of looked the same. Like, it wasn't like that. Everyone kept commenting and being like, it looks like a maybe like XFL uniform or something. And I remember when Atlanta did that, Atlanta had the weird numbers where it looked like it was like a, you would have worn these in your like softball league at the beach. And those ones I remember being ugly, but I really can't see it with Denver. I don't know. Maybe it's because orange is my favorite color. So when I see orange, I like it. I don't know. But there was a lot, because I even posted it. Multiple people were like, ah, they're terrible. And I'm like, okay, I don't get it, but whatever.
More so their video announcing it looked like a Ford commercial. I saw a lot of memes regarding that. Also, the fact that the Denver, yes, it is a Broncos town first and foremost, but the fact that the Nuggets went on a buzzer beater last night, the Avalanche are in the postseason as well and playing very well, and the Broncos are out here, trading for Zach Wilson, and then they're like, oh, by the way, we also have new uniforms. Here you go. Like,
they needed a distraction.
Where's your marketing team? Like, come on. Like, I understand these things happen. You can't always predict baseball, Susan, but like, I mean, let's be a little more strategic, and I understand the date had been set for when they'd announce it. As for the Texans uniforms, I've seen some people who say it looks like an Arena League uniform. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of the ones that I hear. Yeah. Like, if that's what anybody uses to make fun of one, it's usually something along the lines of that.
They're all, I mean, the all reds last year that they did, and the red helmet. I know people from my friends in Houston, like, people love that. So
yeah. I kind of like the red. I just don't like that H, like, whatever old school looks like it was written with like a pen that you had to dip in the ink and then sign things back in the day.
The calligraphy?
Yes, yes.
I also did see someone talking about the Jaguars throwbacks that the official account had tweeted out not too long ago. And they were like, can you really do a throwback when the team is just 30 years old, just barely 30 years old? And I was like, okay, I kind of understand that slight criticism. But at the same time, it does feel like a long time ago for those of us who were paying attention to the Jaguars back in the 90s.
Can I give you guys a fun fact since we brought up Zach Wilson and we didn't get a chance to discuss that trade yesterday? This is from ESPN Stats and Info. Since total QBR was first introduced in 2006, there have been 38 quarterbacks who started at least 30 games in their first three seasons. The lowest QBRs in that span. Zach Wilson with 33.6 is the lowest. Trent Edwards, 37.5 with the Buffalo Bills. Blake Bortles, 41.4. Sam Darnold, 41.7. And Mark Sanchez, 42.7. Which is amazing considering Mark Sanchez went to back-to-back AFC championship games with those stats. Obviously a legendary defense, but...
Sam Darnold also may get an opportunity to start again.
Yeah, he may.
Even if the Vikings don't
Well, even if I think they get the quarterback, I feel like he's still going
to
start.
I don't know that, but if they take a quarterback, yes, he might get a quote-unquote chance to start, but I don't think that he's going to get the legitimate chance to start.
It's with the eye of, like, the quarterback will be here at some point, just how soon.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There's been a lot of chatter around the league regarding the progression of Jordan Love, and if a J.J. McCarthy isn't ready, if he's to fall to the Giants, or the Vikings don't have to trade up to four to get him. Could there be a situation where they let him sit for a year behind a Sam Darnold? If they do, the person who gets the most credit in the world and is going to look the best coming out of this situation is Kyle Shanahan, because that would suggest that the quarterback rehab he's out there building on the West Coast worked, because Sam Darnold, whether he's able to take the Vikings to the playoffs or not, if they're competitive with him, maybe he gets another job, even if J.J. McCarthy is the future, if that's the route they go.
All right, I've got a Scottie Scheffler fun fact for y'all. This year, Rory McIlroy has made $1.71 million in PGA Tour earnings. Rory McIlroy, $1.71 million in PGA Tour earnings. Scottie Scheffler's caddy, Ted Scott, has made approximately $1.78 million.
That's a saucy nug, RJ. Jeez.
So there you go.
I had just
saucy
read
nugs.
I had just read the one yesterday, I think, to you guys off air, where it was like Scheffler has made 16.7 or something like that million in just his last five.
Just his last five starts, and it's always good for the caddy when that happens. All right, we will come back with a little bit more on the NFL draft as far as Mia's latest mock draft. Also, Prisco's Who They Should Take draft. Interesting stuff there. You are listening to Helmets and Heels on 1010 XL 92.5 FM.
Helmets and Heels.
This hour is brought to you by First Coast Honda Dealers.
This is Helmets and Heels.
Kept classy by First Coast Lighting and Fans. Upscale lighting, fans, and home decor.
On 1010 XL.
Well, we've reached pretty much the end of mock draft, because the actual draft is a little over 48 hours away. Thursday night, 8 p.m., the first round. Of course, it'll continue Friday and Saturday as well. Mia, your mock draft 4.0, this is your final mock draft.
Yes. Apparently, according to multiple listeners and viewers online, the worst mock draft they've ever seen. Well, if 4.0 isn't your fancy, there's a 1.0, a 2.0, and a 3.0, and they're all available at 1010XL.com. As I tweeted yesterday, this scenario, in my eyes, is probably the third or fourth most likely of the bunch, although it's pretty timely because I do have the Jaguars trading up to number 14, where they would select Quinyon Mitchell, the cornerback out of Toledo, who, of course, we heard from his position coach at the University of Toledo earlier in the program. If you want to go back and listen on demand, Corey Parker was amazing, lit, as the kids like to say. Look, I think
that... Do
they
still say that?
Yeah, I think they do. They say no cap, too. Those are the two things they say. Look, I think that Quinyon Mitchell and Terrion Arnold have definitively separated themselves among the cornerback class as the top two guys. But to Trent Baalke's point from last Thursday, I'm not sure it's quite as big a gap as the wide receiver top three have separated themselves. And so at the end of the day, and Trent talked about this, like, cornerback, when it comes to this class, which is extremely deep, and I do believe the Jaguars believe that because I've been told that, they think they could find a starting caliber corner at number 48 or number 96 overall. It's a lot about your flavor. It's a lot about what matches your defense, what may match your defense, may not match somebody else, who's a fit. Whereas with wide receiver, I think that as much as there's depth to be had there, it's a lot more whoever is the most well-rounded, high floor, you need to jump on that guy. Whereas with the defensive backs, and especially knowing you brought in Chris Richard, who was a legendary coacher of DBs up in Seattle with the Legion of Boom, you brought in Ryan Nielsen, the expectation, not that you wouldn't be able to develop a wide receiver the same way, but you would be able to develop a corner perhaps more efficiently than you would, who has a high floor in terms of their intangibles, in terms of their measurables, as opposed to a wide receiver who could help you immediately.
But so are you saying, though, that the – for a corner, you want one, you think more of scheme fit and how they directly could be dropped in.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's more about the scheme fit, which I think Quinyon would be a scheme fit.
Yes.
More than a Cooper DeJean, more than a Nate Wiggins, personally speaking. In this situation, the reason I have the Jaguars trade up to 14 is because Terrion Arnold was selected 13th overall by the Raiders. And we saw the reports yesterday, and if you didn't look them up, they're everywhere, that Howie Roseman and the Philadelphia Eagles could be trying to trade into the top 20 so they can select a corner. Mm-hmm. We heard from Angela with Wish TV in Indianapolis yesterday. The Colts could be in the corner market at 15. And so in this mock draft scenario, I have the Jaguars trading up to ensure they do get their guy. Okay. And could it happen? I mean, certainly. Again, Trent Baalke said 12, 13, 14, how many times? And if you subscribe to the school of thought that you're taking him on the surface level, sure, maybe that's what he was alluding to.
Yeah.
But I do think Quinyon Mitchell is a good player who would fit the Jaguars' scheme, what they're looking for, hard-nosed guy. We heard from his coach, and he stressed just how much of a hard worker he is and the type of player, the type of person the Jags want in the building at the Miller Electric Center.
And the reason I asked Coach Parker about the interceptions is because that's kind of the only knock really on Quinyon Mitchell, is the fact that he only had the one interception this past season. But Sauce Gardner didn't have a ton of interceptions in college either.
Right,
and he's obviously been tremendous in the league. And so don't always focus on one stat in particular. And especially like Coach Parker said, he told Quinyon, quarterbacks are not going to throw your way now that they know how good you are because of the 2022 season that he had.
Exactly. Was it, Mia, was it, I know we were going over a different mock draft and they had a comp. Was it Quinyon or was it Terrion who they compared to Jalen Johnson?
Believe it was.
That was the Athletic. That was the Beast that Dan Brugler put out.
I think it was Terrion.
I was trying to remember which one they said that.
I think it was Terry.
Because he had similar, and I just mentioned that because of the interceptions. That was the knock on Jalen for a long time, too, and it took a few seasons, but then it progressively got better, and that's something he started just seeing the field better as he was getting more comfortable in the NFL, and obviously what's surrounding you, too, the other corners that are on the field with you and the scheme that they run and all of those things. So it's something that you could even start to see an uptick as he got into the NFL, too.
It should be noted, yes, and for as much as I went on Jaguars today and I said that, yes, I think that wide receiver in the first could very much be a reality, opposed to everyone who says there's only going to be two cornerbacks under contract in 2025 right now, you need to get one. I could see a world in which they double dip. If they take one in the third, they take another in the fourth. They have 2 fourth-round picks. They take one in the first, they take another in the third, because you don't have Trey Herndon on the roster right now. And I don't know if this new staff likes Christian Braswell at the nickel as much as the previous staff did. So as much as I have been banging that wide receiver drum and saying that it needs to be accepted as a potential reality, I'm not dismissing the fact that they do need cornerback help. Like, they're going to need it. But as we heard Ira Shaffel of WarChant.com say, if you could get a Renardo Green at 96, I mean, by all accounts, the dude had Malik Nabers and Brian Thomas Jr. in HE double hockey sticks in the opener last year in Orlando. You're telling me that guy's not going to translate to the league if those two wide receivers are? And if you can get him in the second or third round? So I think that I need to make that distinction. And also, this is, again, one of four mock drafts that I have put together at 1010XL.com. So don't take this as this is the one that she's subscribing to.
It was Terrion Arnold that they said the comp was Jalen Johnson. So, yeah.
With their second pick, I have the Jaguars trading back from number 48. So they trade up to number 14. Then they trade back from number 48 to number 60 with the Buffalo Bills. And they select Jalen McMillan, wide receiver, Washington, who they had in for a top 30 visit, who they've done a ton of homework on, who is a hurt guy. Mm-hmm. If not for the fact that he missed much of last season, I think we'd be talking about him more as a top 30, top 40 pick, as opposed to a top 80 pick. He came back from a knee injury to catch 20 passes for 222 yards and 2 touchdowns between the Pac-12 title game, the college football playoff semifinal, and the national title game. Pretty high stakes games and performed pretty admirably. And if you're concerned about consistency, flashes in the pan, he caught 39 passes for 470 yards his redshirt freshman year, 79 catches for over 1,000 yards, 9 touchdowns in 2022. And again, would have been on a trajectory to surpass those numbers his final season in Seattle.
Yeah, a lot of the things they say about him, I spoke briefly on him on one of my podcasts, but a lot of his stuff is just his route running, his football IQ are a lot of the things they talk about. Obviously, a pretty decent size, but he also can be used as a deep threat and a slot guy. He did both. So those are things that it gives you a little flexibility when you get a receiver like that, too.
In the third round, another trade. I have the Jaguars, and this I do think is pretty realistic, regardless of if it's for this player or whatever the situation may be, because there is just such an ocean between 48 and 96. I have them trading up 3 picks to number 93. They give up 114 and 116. And in turn, the Jaguars select Jalix Hunt, the edge rusher out of Houston Christian, which, of course, also the alma mater of Caleb Johnson, special teams ace here in Duval. Hunt is definitely another one of those project edge rushers, which I don't think we've talked enough about, because we talk about the depth of the wide receiver and the depth of the cornerback class so much. With this edge rusher class, I'm not saying it's like a cliff, but it's very much you go from
pretty steep.
Jared Verse, Dallas Turner, Latu, Marshawn Nealon, and then it's guys who are straight up projects, converted former safeties, converted former inside linebackers, 20-year-olds like Jonah Ellis out of Utah, who I have in another previous mock draft. But Hunt's a fascinating one because the measurables are very much bulky built. 6'4", 252 pounds, 34 3/8-inch arms, second among all linebackers at the combine. He did put significant numbers out there at Houston Christian. And again, you can joke that that's Houston Christian all you want. Final two seasons after starting his college career at Cornell University, 20.5 tackles for loss, 13.5 sacks, 5 forced fumbles. So is he a small school version of Yannick Ngakoue, albeit a different build and with still more room to grow in his frame, would be the argument.
Well, and I think that if you, like you said, if you're not getting an edge in with one of those first two, then you will probably want to knock it out at that next one. And when you look at positional needs of what we've been talking about for the Jaguars, I feel like most people would leave this happy if you were knocking out a corner, a wide receiver, and an edge with your first three picks.
Yeah, they're just going to be like, Jalix Hunt, who is that? And why are you going to such a small school? But this is where you get to the value, and whether they need to trade up to get him, we shall see, certainly. But I think at the end of the day, you've got a guy that had productivity. And so, like you said, Mia, especially with the measurables, that may be a guy that Trimbalky looks back, maybe, we doubt it, but says, maybe I should have gone with Aiden Hutchinson over Trayvon Walker, but I loved the measurables so much of Trayvon Walker. And again, Trayvon's fine and everything, but you have to wonder if, once you start to see some of the mistakes you've made in the past, and I'm not calling Trayvon a mistake, but if he starts to change his philosophy.
Thank you, Jacob, on the YouTube chat line. Mia sounds like Bulky with this mock projects and injuries. Yes, that is the intent. I'm trying to give you a dose,
get into the mind
a dose of what Trent Bulky is thinking. That's part of my job as a reporter, and following those trends, following the lineage of how he has drafted before. But again, as I said in the 12 o'clock hour, that's not to say he can't break tradition, that he can't break his tendencies, especially as so many folks nationally are saying Chris Ballard could do that in Indianapolis. I think there's a world in which Trent Baalke says, all right, you want to question me? You want to send more clown dolls to my office? I'm going to trade into the top 10 for Malik Nabers or Roman Dunze. So, yes, Mock Draft 4.0 has me trading up for Quinyon Mitchell. Is that actually what I think? Well, that's why there's four of these mock drafts. And quickly, I'll just run through the other picks, and you can check it out at 1010XL.com before we take our next break. I have the Jaguars with the fourth-round pick they acquired from the Buffalo Bills in this hypothetical trade, selecting Brandon Coleman, the tackle guard out of TCU, a poor man's Troy Fatanu, if you may. In the sixth round, I have them picking Joshua Cardy, kicker out of Stanford. Ooh. And then in round 7 with the 236th overall pick, for you Noles fans, I have them selecting Fabian Lovett, senior defensive tackle out of Florida State. And of course, you can check it out at 1010XL.com. Slide on down to where it says Jaguars posts. You click on the Jaguars flash banner, and you'll see all of our stories, articles, and of course, our 1010XL draft guide, which if you haven't printed it out and checked it out yet, make sure you do so.
Make sure you have a lot of ink because it is 99 pages. Prisco has a who they should draft. We'll look at who he has the Jaguars taking. I know Taylor's not thrilled with who he has the Bears taking number one, but
I think
either
he was
way,
drunk.
We'll look at who he has the Jaguars taking. You're listening to Helmets and Heels 1 segment to go here on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
This hour of Helmets and Heels is brought to you by First Coast Honda Dealers. Helmets and Heels is switched on by
First Coast Lighting and Fans,
upscale lighting, fans, and home decor on 1010XL.
Just a couple reminders. Tomorrow is the Media Mock Draft. Mike Dempsey, Tony Smith, Dylan Denmark, they'll handle picks 1 through 16. And then we are on the clock, ladies, as soon as the show starts at noon. Frank Frangie, the voice of the Jacksonville Jaguars, will be making the pick. And then we will continue the Media Mock Draft until pick 32. No trades allowed. We can't bring chaos into the Media Mock Draft. But it should be a lot of fun. And also, reminder that on Thursday, we will be at Mr. Chubby's in Ponte Vedra. And on Friday, at Players Grill Mandarin, of course, noon to 2 p.m. for both of those. I mentioned Prisco's who they should draft. Instead of going Caleb Williams, he went Jaden Daniels at one. That's who he thinks the Bears should take. Taylor's shaking your head.
That's so weird.
When it comes to the Jaguars, though, he has the Jaguars taking Terrion Arnold. I think that makes a lot of sense to everyone. The question is, will Quinyon Mitchell, will Terrion Arnold still be there at 17 if the Jaguars stay at 17?
And again, there's no trades in this situation. It's a matter of who's on the board. And so in this situation, he says the Cardinals, another hot take, by the way, from Pete Prisco on CBS Sports, should take Malik Nabers over Marvin Harrison Jr.
A lot of people believe Nabers is better than Harrison Jr.
And there are several teams that have him ahead of Marvin Harrison Jr. on their board, by the way, which then Marvin Harrison Jr., if you're Jim Harbaugh and Joe Ortiz, with all the players available, they select Marv. And then
Justin Herbert's throwing a party.
Right. And then the Giants. Right. And then the Giants select Rome Odunze. Again, this is with no trade. This is who is the best player available, who will make your team better right now. Mm-hmm. How many teams actually think that way versus, you know, if you're Jim Harbaugh and you're trying to rebuild this Los Angeles Chargers roster and you want to build it from the trenches, you trade back to acquire more picks, or you opt for an offensive lineman. Byron Murphy has been rumored to potentially be a top 10 pick and the apple of some teams in the top 10's eye. You know, Chop Robinson going 9th overall to the Bears. Again, this is Pete's take on who the best player is, regardless of necessarily what your needs may be. Keep taking your needs into consideration, but knowing who the best player available is. Although I do think Chop Robinson over Jared Verse is fascinating.
And Latu.
Both
are. That's what's weird to me. I was like, you have Latu and Jared Verse sitting on the board, and if they jump to Chop, I would be very confused.
Verse does go 15th to the Colts, so he would be in the Jags division. And then, like I said, Pete has the Jaguars taking Terrion Arnold, and Quinyon Mitchell goes 13th to the Raiders. You've got teams ahead of you if you're the Jags and you stay at 17 that definitely need corners. We've learned that through our process of our countdown to the draft. So that will be, to me, his point to start the show. That will be the question is, do they stay at 17 or do they move up? By the way, quick shout out when it comes to a local sports person that I did not know anything about until yesterday, Christian Miller, the Creekside track star, made history this past weekend. He became the youngest man to ever run the 100-meter race in under 10 seconds. He's 17 years old. He ran a 9.9 meter. He's now the fastest American under the age of 20. He's headed to run track at Georgia, which very close to home as far as Athens to Jacksonville, not too far, I should say. But yeah, I wish he was going to Gainesville and be a little closer to home. But certainly congrats to Christian Miller. That is incredible speed. And yeah, just wanted to give him a shout out. I, ladies, feel like tomorrow our media mock draft is just going to flow seamlessly and we're going to know
exactly. You're a little nervous.
No, not at all. We know exactly who's going to be taken Thursday night because we're going to have the media mock draft tomorrow.
Yeah.
I promise. It's fun. It's fun.
I've done it as the producer. It is an absolute blast if you're the host. For poor RJ as the producer, it is a fast and furious, very stressful time. So, no, I'm not nervous at all. I think it's going to be a blast.
I think it's going to be fun. This is my first year ever participating. Obviously, you've produced, and Mia, you did it last year and the year before, 2 years with Primetime. So this will be my first time actually being a part of the media mock draft. I'm excited because I think we just kind of took this look of like, hey, what are the possibilities of where these teams are possibly thinking? But to actually like get a pick from some of these people and really see, and obviously we're not talking to the GMs of like, hey, who are you picking Thursday?
They didn't answer their phones. I don't know why not.
But still, I feel like these people, just like as much as we talk about it, can at least give you an idea of what three or four guys that they would suspect would be taken.
As opposed to when we've been doing our countdown to 17 and we've been kind. We've said it's not the media mock draft yet. You could tell us a position. You don't have to necessarily tell us exactly what player, but starting tomorrow, ladies, we need to hear exact players, who's on the board, who's not on the board.
That's right. A reminder when it comes to local baseball, Florida's at home versus Stetson tonight, 6:30 first pitch, and 10th-ranked FSU plays host to UNF tonight, first pitch, 6 o'clock. All right, that's going to do it for us. And again, thanks to all of our guests for joining us today. For Taylor Dahl, for Mia O'Brien, for RJ Saunders, I'm Lauren Brooks. XL Primetime is next right here on 1010XL on 2.5 FM. These heels are made for talking. We will talk to you tomorrow for the Media Mock Draft.